I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a conversation with a general who lost two sons, one to combat, one to suicide. And we'll ask, why isn't the military's suicide prevention initiative working better? But first, let's touch down on today's White House summit on community colleges, the first ever. The President Obama wants to tap community colleges to retrain workers for jobs that are in demand and raise graduation rates by 5 million people. Now, community college enrollment did shoot up during the recession. They're popular because they're far less expensive two-year programs. Half of American undergrads are in community college two-year programs. But many people never graduate, and last year's White House initiative to build up community colleges was gutted. Jeff Salingo is editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Jeff, you have a story today in which educators are quoted being very critical of the summit. The president had pledged $12 billion to community colleges, but that got whittled down in Congress to just $2 billion to pay for other things like student aid. So what is the thinking going in today?
Well, there are a lot of disappointed community college folks out there. The president announced this community college summit when he signed the $2 billion bill last March. People thought it was going to be a big deal. People thought that they would give a lot of attention to community colleges. Well, they just announced the date, which is today, just a couple of weeks ago. There were some snafus about who was invited and who wasn't invited. In fact, they ended up disinviting some policy people in order to invite others. It's only going to be a couple of hours. So people felt that it's a big PR move on the part of the White House, but not much is really going to be accomplished.
But on the other hand, the president seems to be pledging new monies, new energy, and sort of taking a stand. It feels as if there is some sort of political divide going on. Explain that.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, there's a stand on two fronts. One is, obviously the Democrats are very worried about losses in the midterm elections in a couple of weeks. And they're basically telling the American people that if the Republicans gain control of Congress, all the money that's being spent on higher education, especially in terms of Pell Grants, the move to direct lending, all of that's going to be at risk if Republicans take control. On another front, there's kind of a competition going on now between community colleges, which are local, public, and the for-profit colleges. And the Obama administration has proposed tightening regulations on for-profit colleges. The Republicans are fighting those on a number of fronts. And again, the Obama administration says that if the Republicans gain control of Congress in a couple of weeks, the for-profits are going to get a leg up come January.
And we have talked with you about this. The for-profits, mostly online universities, there's criticism that they cost much more than the community colleges and that they promise jobs to graduates and that doesn't come to fruition. So there's some controversy in Congress about the for-profits. But meanwhile, why don't more people graduate from community colleges? Is it because of the nature of the student that many of them are also working?
That's part of it. A lot of students go to community colleges with the intention of transferring, so they don't necessarily get enough credits to graduate. Others can't get the classes they need, and this is a big problem now, especially in big states like California and New York.
Well, Jeff, here in Massachusetts, I think we've spoken about this. We have a school, Bunker Hill, which has classes at 1 in the morning. There's a huge waiting list.
There's a huge demand for classes. The community colleges are getting squeezed because most of their funding either comes from the state or from local sources, county governments and other local sources. And those places don't have enough money now to build enough classes that are needed for these students. So many students can't get the classes they need. And if they could get the classes they need, they can't necessarily get the financial aid they need. And so a lot of students kind of come in and come out. They take a class here and there. They may stop for a couple of years. Sometimes they may never go back because of family or job obligations. So it's very tough for students to kind of come in, stay with a program for 2 years, if the program is that long, and graduate with an associate's degree.
Well, today the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation will announce $35 million over 5 years to increase graduation rates. And the president is also announcing a private-public partnership to retrain workers with companies like The Gap and McDonald's, hopefully change some of those statistics about community colleges. Jeff Salingo, editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, thank you as always.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
Now to a very somber topic. More than 100 soldiers have killed themselves this year, including four at Fort Hood in Texas over a recent weekend. The Army says they died by self-inflicted gunshot wounds. And the nation's top military officer says this is only a sign of things to come. Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says he expects military suicide rates to rise even higher as large numbers of troops return home after multiple deployments. Which is why it's so dispiriting that a recent Pentagon Task Force report found the military's prevention efforts, although increased, still inadequate. Well, our next guest is trying to turn that around, and he comes at this from a very personal perspective. Major General Mark Graham's son, Kevin, was a promising young ROTC cadet at the University of Kentucky when he killed himself in 2003. At first, General Graham was reluctant to speak out, but then his other son, Army Lieutenant Jeff Graham, was killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq in 2004. The general says the two deaths were treated differently, and he and his wife, Carol, have been at the forefront of the military's suicide prevention effort ever since. General Graham joins us on the phone from Fort McPherson in Georgia. And, General, there are just no words to convey our sympathy for your loss.
Well, thank you, Robin. I appreciate that.
Two losses. And when you say it was treated differently, what do you mean?
People reacted differently to a suicide versus a son being killed in combat. And, you know, the loss to my wife and I is the same. We've lost, you know, both sons. They died fighting different battles. But our family, our personal family, our military family and friends, and everyone rallied around us. But there is a difference when you lose someone to suicide, and I think that's because of the stigma. When Jeremy was killed in Iraq, of course, you know, there's a thing on TV about him. He was in combat and all this. And, of course, when Kevin died by suicide, it was real. People didn't know, what do you say? What do you do? Do you do the same thing you do? And we said, yes, we're going to do the same thing we would do. We did the same kind of funeral, I mean, they would normally do, so.
Well, and that, yeah, and you mentioned the funeral. There's a military funeral for people killed in combat. There often isn't for people who take their lives. Parents of children killed in combat receive a gold star, often are invited to meet with dignitaries. There's not an equivalent for suicides. And this is something that you and your wife and others have been working on. But when you say your son, Kevin, who took his life, was fighting a different battle, can we ask you about that in order to understand the problem that we want to talk about, the wider problem of suicides? Do you know what battle your son, Kevin, was fighting?
I do. Kevin was fighting depression. At the University of Kentucky, just finished his junior year, getting ready to go to the Army's, it's called Warrior Forge. It's an ROTC advanced training camp up in Fort Lewis, Washington. He was supposed to go there a week later, and Kevin was on depression medications. We think he came off his medications is what's been determined, and we think a lot of that was surrounded by the stigma. He did not want to sign in and say, this is the medication I'm on, because he was on Prozac, and there's just stigma with depression medicine still. And so Kevin was battling with depression, and he knew he had it. Kevin was a very, very bright young man. He wanted to be an Army doctor.
Oh, we understand he was chosen for elite airborne training. He was a commander of other cadets, and according to the officers who worked with him, he was on the road to a very successful military career.
He was, but he was fighting a battle in his mind. And I tell people, Kevin was running for his life. He had a stack of Men's Health magazines in his closet. He was doing all he could to stay healthy. And he told me, I said, Kevin, when I saw him at our son Jeff's graduation, I said, Kevin, I've never seen you look better. And he looked at me and said, Dad, I'm running twice a day. I'm working out. He said, it's helping me feel good. And what we did not know then was when you exercise, it increases your serotonin levels.
Right.
So Kevin was literally running for his life, trying to do physical training as much as he could to keep the serotonin levels up.
Serotonin, which is a mood enhancer in the brain.
Exactly.
And so he was trying to offset his depression with that. And you knew this. I mean, according to reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, you saw that there were some problems of the stress he was under. You were telling him to take some time off. And General Graham, this gets to a question. You know, a lot of people are wondering about the broader rate of suicide in the military, the huge numbers. A lot of, you know, reasons are given. But in 2008, a third of the suicides were of people who hadn't even been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. And it raises the question, do you think that there are, because of the need for troops, do you think that there are possibly young people going into the military who maybe shouldn't because they suffer from depression or some of these other mental health problems?
The Army is looking at that very hard. We do have young people coming in that have not deployed, that are taking their own life. But on the other side, I'm not sure if you looked at the civilian communities and gathered the data from the civilian communities, what those numbers would look like.
Yeah,
because I truly think this is bigger than a military problem. I think the military is really taking it on. So is the nation in some ways, but in some communities, but not across the country. Frankly, I mean, suicide is the number two cause of death in college students, which is surprising. My wife and I did not know you could die from being too sad. And that's one thing we were trying to help people understand is, I mean, depression is real. You can get in front of this, and we need to get in front of it because you need to know the warning signs to see when your loved one's changing. We knew there was problems. We knew Kevin had problems. We knew he was struggling. But frankly, we didn't do the right thing. We failed him.
Well, and as you said, you say you'll blame yourself for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
But now you and your wife have taken on, along with you know, a lot of other people, trying to change some of the thinking in the military. When you were at Fort Carson, we understood that you started enacting a lot of these things that you hoped would help with suicide prevention, including starting mobile behavioral health teams, you know, mental health professionals who would work with troops during and after their time in Iraq and Afghanistan. Because prior to that, we understood that troops were only screened when they came back and they had no access overseas to mental health.
They do get screened overseas now. It's more now than it was in the past. They do get screened before they come home, and then they relay that information back to the medical care facilities here back in the States so that you can see if you're going to need a surge of behavioral health specialists and counselors, that you can do that. When we were at Fort Carson, everyone was trying to come up with ways and what our thoughts would be on how we can help things, and in our hospital, hospital came up with the mobile behavioral health thought to do that, and I said, do it, and they did, and it's not a very big team, it's a small team, but it's down within a brigade size unit, with brigades about 3,000, 3,500 soldiers, but you put a mobile behavioral health team down in the battalion area, in the brigade area where the soldiers work and live, and the idea there is to make it very accessible, so it's just like walking down the hall to see the personnel people, it's like walking down the hall to see the aid station to get some care. You know, go see the chaplain in the chaplain's office, go over and see the behavioral health guy, team. So it would help take away the stigma that it was, hey, if you need help, go get help. You know, if you're having some tough thoughts, if you're having depression, if you're having suicidal thoughts or anything, go see the behavioral health guys. It's okay. Yeah. PTSD, go see the behavioral health guys. It's okay. Traumatic brain injury, same thing. Go see the behavioral health guys. It's okay. So it was just to make it part of your day. It's like you would go anywhere else for help. Every door a soldier goes in for care and for help should be the right door.
Major General Mark Graham, his son Kevin killed himself in 2003 when Kevin was an ROTC cadet at the University of Kentucky. 2 years later, his other son Jeff was killed in Iraq by a roadside bomb. And the way the suicide death was stigmatized launched General Graham into the fight to change the way the military treats suicide. But when we come back, why his efforts don't seem to be working, at least according to a recent Pentagon report, troops still don't trust the people assigned to help them. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Army Major General Mark Graham. Tough subject. One of the general's sons, Lieutenant Jeff Graham, was killed in combat in Iraq in 2005. 2 years earlier, his son Kevin killed himself when he was a promising ROTC cadet at the University of Kentucky. Today, General Graham is part of the military's push to reduce military suicides. And General Graham, despite the initiatives you took at Fort Carson, we just talked about the mobile behavioral health teams that traveled with battalions to war zones, despite more screening, there have still been dozens of military suicides this year, more than 300 last year. And the Pentagon's recent task force report concludes prevention efforts just don't seem to be working. Why do you think that is?
Well, a couple things. One is you often hear the numbers and statistics of those who lost by suicide. But what you never hear is the number of soldiers' lives are being saved because of all the efforts going on out there to take care of them. And you probably won't ever see those numbers. But we know there are soldiers that are coming forward now more than ever before to get help. They are asking for help and care, and that's the stigma. You know, if we can reduce the stigma to where soldiers feel like, you know, it's okay to go to the doctor, it's okay to go to the chaplain, it should be okay to go see the behavioral health specialist. And there should be no stigma surrounding that for a person to go get behavioral health care.
Well, but according to this report, and this is what was unearthed a few years ago, Daniel Zwerdling at NPR and others, you know, really dug deep and found that the complete opposite was happening. When troops came in with PTSD or depression, they were actually mocked. And as you said, now there's been a lot of efforts, largely because of you and other people. But this report finds that troops still don't seek help. They still don't trust the military to help them. And commanders still aren't trained on what to do. According to one report, people running some of these sessions, you know, mock people still.
Well, I mean, that continues to go after the stigma. Because the stigma's not, it's in every part of it. It's got to be touched. And frankly, it just takes time to do this. And we wish we could, I mean, I wish I could wave my hand and it would be gone. And I know we got senior leaders that wish they could wave their hand and it would be gone. But we all know, you know, it takes time to change a culture.
Yeah.
And if you go out and talk to civilian communities, I think you'll find a lot of the same culture out there. Not the military-type culture, but the thoughts and perceptions of behavior health care,
right,
and depression. And it's just like, you know, people just, you know, they just think, what's wrong with you? Well, and when my wife speaks, she often talks, you know, if it's something from the neck down, it's not a problem to get help for it. But when it's something from the neck up, then people start questioning, like, well, what's wrong with you? I mean, because they can't physically tell something's wrong, you know, that you've got depression. They don't understand it. I mean, there's been a lot of people that have now started coming out saying, hey, I've had depression. I mean, that helps when people do that because it is real. Depression is real, and it's an illness. Now, does it take medication to help every time? Not necessarily. Sometimes it's, you know, situational depression, but sometimes it's chronic, and it is truly an illness where you need medical care for it. So what we tell people is go see medical professionals. Let medical professionals make the determination of the treatment plan for you.
Some of the other issues that people point to as being behind the rise in suicides in the military, Secretary Gates said at one point he believes it's because of the Army's rising divorce rate, and that has to do with all the deployments. Others point to drug and alcohol use. Then there's the economy, foreclosures on military bases. But whatever the reason, this task force report found the military doesn't have enough behavioral specialists or suicide prevention specialists. It needs better training. In fact, it concludes this: either the size of the military needs to grow and include all of these people, or the mission demands need to be reduced. Where do you see this heading?
Well, I know the military has put resources in. I know the Army have put a lot of resources into it. And make it a priority. Could we use more resources to do it? Absolutely. And do we need more behavioral health specialists? Absolutely. I do think there are people working at it. Is it enough? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I wish I could tell you how much is enough. I do think we're seeing some progress and some help. And again, what we don't know is how many soldiers have not taken their life that might have previously. If they didn't feel comfortable going and getting care, or their buddy didn't help them and take them in to get them care.
General Graham, it sounds as if, despite this report, you have to tell yourself. Now, it sounds as if some good has been done. As you said, we're not hearing, you know, if even one life is saved, that's good. It sounds like we're not hearing the glass half full. But I'm wondering, too, if you have to tell yourself that some good has to come of what you and your wife have tried to do.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, they're all Kevins out there to me, and Kevin was a bright young man with a wonderful future ahead of him. And he had depression, and it's not something he chose. It's something that chose him, and it's an illness, and he had it, and we didn't know enough about it to help get him the right help that he needed to save his life, because we know people that are on depression medicine, have been for years and years, and they're leading fine, productive lives because they got the right care early on. And we didn't get that for Kevin. I think our military, you know, the report that came out, I mean, there's a couple different reports that have come out. I think that just shows you how much the military's trying. Is, you know, they're doing studies, they're looking at this to see how best we can help save lives of our young soldiers that have done so much for the nation. And are we doing enough? Are we, you know, when we lose one soldier, one too many.
Have you been able to change the way soldiers who die by suicide are memorialized?
My understanding is the Army has made that clear that soldiers are memorialized in the same way. A soldier joins the Army to fight and serve for his nation. To me, a soldier that dies by suicide, you know, they're fighting their own battle. You know, you got to look at what they've done for the nation, not how they die, but what they've done
or what they were willing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's Major General Mark Graham. He's currently at Fort McPherson in Atlanta, Georgia, speaking to us about suicide prevention in the military. The general lost two sons who served. General Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
Well, your thoughts? You can just go to hearnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email or make a phone call, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there, hearandnow.org. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. 54-year-old Liu Xiaobo is a Chinese writer and human rights activist currently serving an 11-year prison term in China for inciting subversion of state power. And this Friday, he could also become the first Chinese citizen to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Liu has been a leading figure in the struggle for human rights and democracy in China since the days of the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. This isn't his first time in jail, and of course, Chinese officials aren't keen on him winning the prize. They say his actions are diametrically opposed to the aims of the Nobel. But Liu has received several nominations, including one from the Pen American Center, the world's oldest international literary and human rights organization. Larry Seams is director of the center's Freedom to Write program, and Larry joins us from New York. Does Liu even know he's been nominated?
I believe he does. He has a monthly prison visit with his wife, and I know that she's well aware of the nominations or several nominations that he's received, and I am pretty sure she's communicated the news to him.
Well, and tell us more about him. Is he well known in China?
Among the dissidents, he's one of the most well-known dissidents. He has been on the scene, as you said, for almost three decades. He came to prominence, especially during Tiananmen Square. He is a professor of poetry and a literary critic who was actually outside of China in the spring of 1989, but went home as the demonstrations were mounting in Tiananmen Square. And as a professor at Beijing Normal University, sort of assumed a leadership role in the final days of the demonstrations and was able to actually, is credited with preventing enormous bloodshed, you know, in the final hours when he persuaded most of the students to leave the square before the tanks rolled in. And, you know, he has remained on the scene one of the most unbending, you know, and clear voices for democratic reform in China. He was jailed, as you said, in the 1990s. And when he came out, the Internet had become a major tool for disseminating information. And he began to publish essays on the Internet. And it was for five of those essays, plus this manifesto called Charter 08 that was published in December 2008, that he was arrested and has been sentenced to 11 years in prison.
The Charter 08 manifesto calling for political reform, greater human rights, an end to one-party rule in China. His trial lasted less than 3 hours. His defense wasn't allowed to present evidence. And he's now not yet 1 year into his 11-year sentence. But does he have, he's known perhaps, but does he have support in China?
I think he does. I mean, you know, I think what he has done is he really, throughout his career, has managed to sort of articulate and channel the frustrations of the Chinese people. Charter 08, as a document, garnered over 10,000 signatures from ordinary Chinese citizens, from farmers to former government officials. And, you know, they have risen in support of him and by signing the Charter 08. And more recently, in the past month, you know, spontaneously circulating a petition which 300 Chinese signed, reiterating support for his election for the Nobel Prize.
Well, but 300 and even several thousand out of, you know, what, a billion Chinese. So I guess I raise it because the Chinese government obviously doesn't support him. And they're in the midst of trade talks with Norway, where the prizes are awarded, and are lobbying against it.
Well, they certainly are. I mean, this is pro forma for the Chinese government. I mean, the Nobel Committee has made quite clear they don't take kindly to the kind of pressure that they receive from the Chinese government, and I hope that the selection process isn't affected by it. I don't believe it will be.
What would it mean if he does win, if the Chinese suddenly have someone imprisoned winning the Peace Prize?
Well, I think it'll be an enormous gesture that will be understood by the Chinese people to be a great support for the movement for greater democratic participation in China. I mean, I think people will know about it. China has for, you know, decades been obsessed with the Nobel Prize. In fact, before Liu Xiaobo was famous, he was known to be quite an acerbic and sharp-tongued critic, and he was very critical early on of what he called the Chinese government's, you know, childish obsession with the Nobel Prize, and particularly with the fact that it had never won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So, you know, China is clearly aware of the Nobel Prizes. They've coveted the prizes. And, you know, if one of their own won the Nobel Peace Prize, and yet it was one who was disfavored by the government, I think that the people will understand that message loud and clear.
Larry, thank you. We're up against a break. We'll be back and follow the story of Liu Xiaobo. Back in 30 seconds here and now. Our next guest poses this question. You know what ingredients are in your cereal, but why don't you know what's in your cookware or your catalytic converter? Salim Ali is a professor of environmental studies at the University of Vermont. He says we need to know the elements in the things we use because elements, like metals, are finite, and tracking them will help us know how to recycle them so we can use them again. Professor Ali recently made a passionate call in the Chronicle Review for what he calls elemental accounting, designing products so that recycling isn't an afterthought, but it's part of the product design. He's also written a book, Treasures of the Earth, Need, Greed, and a Sustainable Future, and joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Professor Ali, Salim, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And I read you've been quoted as saying as well that, you know, when I say the word sustainability, that sometimes implies for people, you know, using less of things and only using what you need. And you seem to be saying, well, actually, you know, let's use what we want, but make sure that we know how to reuse it?
Yes, what I'm trying to get at is that just asking for people to consume less is somewhat idealistic. What's more significant is how we consume, what we consume, where it's coming from. So what I tried to do is to lay out a plan for how we might keep track of the elements. And by the elements, I mean the periodic table of elements, the most significant sort of material code of all existence. It's amazing how few of my students even know what elements are in the basic products that they consume, whether it's their laptop or their Pyrex cookware. They don't know what elements constitute it, whereas they're at pains to try and understand what's in their food and where it's grown and so on. And the products are just as important in our lives now as the food we consume.
Well, it's interesting. I have a copy of the periodic table right in front of me. And this is the second time in 2 weeks that I've done that. We just seem to be talking about the periodic table a lot. But there's, chromium and manganese and gallium and, what's down here? Holmium. I admit to not even knowing what some of them are, but you're saying we should break it down for us. Are you saying manufacturers should know and keep track so that they can build things with their future in mind, you know, already knowing how they might recycle some of the elements? Or are you saying consumers should know?
Well, society at large should know, including regulators, product designers, and consumers. And the way to do it is to vitalize this field of industrial ecology, which gained currency in the last 15 years or so. And what industrial ecology suggests is that industry is now here to stay, and it should be considered as part of the natural ecosystem in terms of its permanence. And this is, of course, anathema to many environmentalists. And what we're saying is that now, for better or for worse, it's here to stay. And so it's best for us to think in those terms of processes in industry in the same way. And industry consumes the elements, and keeping track of them in the same way that we keep track of what we eat and what wastes come out is essential for us to have a sustainable society.
Well, you mentioned waste, and you give some examples of that. So let's just go through some of them. Pyrex is one, heat-resistant cookware. These require the element boron. It takes me back to high school, and we thought it was so funny to call each other borons. But it's rare, 70% of it mined in Turkey, and we have no organized program for recycling borosilicate glass. So you seem to be making the case that, gee, somebody could really benefit if they could figure out a way how to take it and recycle it into something else.
Here's a very important item in terms of not just cookware, but lab equipment, We need heat-resistant glass in many different processes, and it's dependent on this element boron, which is relatively scarce, and it's highly concentrated in the mines in Turkey. And we don't know what will happen if those mines run out. Now, the good news is that elements in their basic form are quite indestructible. I mean, the only way to convert one element into another is through a nuclear reaction, and those aren't too easy to come by. And so the elements themselves are indefinitely renewable, if you think about it. The problem is you need energy to be able to renew them.
Here's another example, catalytic converters in cars. These, of course, reduce pollution, but right now people don't know what to recycle them into?
60% of all mined platinum actually goes into catalytic converters in cars, and people often think most platinum is used in jewelry. So what would happen in terms of our pollution control technology with catalytic converters if we were not able to have that platinum or the palladium, rhodium, other kinds of metals which are used in these processes? So finding a way to keep track of them is important. Now, of late, what's happened is that a lot of activists and the popular media has raised the alarm about scarcity, but they do it in a somewhat negative way, saying, you know, what will happen if China controls 90% of the rare earth metals? And what I'm saying is we shouldn't look at it cynically that way. We should approach it more in terms of an opportunity for technology and policymakers to find a solution so that we can actually have a sustainable society, create new kinds of livelihoods. And that would hopefully move us in the direction of sustainability.
In other words, demonstrate to the industry that they can make money by doing this and create jobs by doing this, and
yes,
as opposed to the scare tactics. But we've seen that often industry doesn't necessarily walk that path. Do you think there has to be some sort of regulation, some government role in this?
Absolutely. It's a call for constructive consumption and targeted technology innovation forcing regulations. We need to create the mechanisms and the incentives for companies to recover these materials. The only way to do that constructively is to start at the design phase. You know, you can't start right at the end once the product is all done and then you try to figure out a solution, because then the industry will come back and say, it's not economical for us to recover these. You need too much energy, or there's just too much diffuse usage. With cell phones, there has been a push towards recycling, but even with all the activism, only 10% of cell phones are recycled. The good news with cell phones is about 44% of the unused cell phones are still lying in people's drawers. So there is a potential opportunity for those to be put to use, but they will still not be as good as the ones which are designed better in the future to be recycled and reused.
So it'll be paper, plastic, glass, and cobalt, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Yes. University of Vermont Professor of Environmental Studies Salim Ali making a call for elemental accounting, knowing the elements of a product going into its production and have a plan for their afterlife. His book is Treasures of the Earth, Need, Greed, and a Sustainable Future, and we'll link you to his article in the Chronicle Review at our website, hereandnow.org. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain. Finally, the first volume of his autobiography can be published. He'd requested that it be locked in a vault for a century, and here we are. We'll have a review of the book when it comes out. But it got us wondering, will he say anything about the stories he fabricated as a young reporter? That's a fact we learn from the book Literary Hoaxes, An Eye-Opening History of Famous Frauds. It's by Melissa Katsoulis. Twain's yarns as a news reporter were part of a tradition of hoaxes that stretched back centuries and continue today. Remember James Frey's public spanking on the Oprah Winfrey Show for fabricating parts of his memoir of drug addiction, A Million Little Pieces? Well, we spoke to Melissa Katsoulis in January of this year and started with that big fat liar, Mark Twain.
He's one of my favorites. I mean, everyone knows he's a great writer with the gift of the gab and an amazing imagination. But I think many of his early readers, when he was first a young journalist in Virginia City, swallowed a lot more than they should have done when they were reading his work.
Well, even his name is not true. His real name, as we all know, is
exactly
Samuel Longhorn Clemens. But as a journalist on Slow Days, he'd just make things up.
He did, and they now seem like incredibly tall tales that nobody could believe. They often had amazing clues in them. But yeah, he sat down and made up absurd stories about the things that were happening around about the city where he lived. And none of them were true.
Here's one from 1862. A petrified Shah, S-H-A-H, was found some time ago in the mountains south of Gravelly Ford. Every limb and feature of the stone mummy was perfect, not even excepting the left leg, which had evidently been a wooden one during the lifetime of the owner. People bought it?
Completely. And of course, he very cleverly said he was astonished that anyone believed it. You know, he didn't mean to trick anyone. How could people possibly believe this nonsense? But people did. I guess it was the early days of sensationalist journalism, and that's what they wanted to read.
You say there are actually three kind of genres, subsets of hoaxes. What are they?
There are hoaxes that are done for entrapment. Someone wants to prick the pretensions of a rival or another academic, for example. Then there are some that are done for artistic ends. You know, maybe someone really wants, a poet wants to find a new voice in their work, so they kind of inhabit the character of someone else. But perhaps the ones that we're most familiar with today are those that are done simply to get money and fame. We associate those with memoir. I think that's the genre we would most associate that with.
Well, then there's also the nefarious hoaxes. And to me, in reading your book, the one that stands out the most is the Protocols of Zion, written by a Russian secret police officer purporting to be a meeting of Jewish leaders seeking world domination. What kind of life did that take on?
Well, I think that's an example of, you know, the terrible power of a text in history. I mean, here was something which in retrospect looks pretty ridiculous. Unfortunately, that is still taken as gospel, if that's the right word, in some countries still today. It's been used consistently over the decades and now centuries as ammunition for anti-Semitic propagandists. And it's really taken on an unpleasant life of its own.
Well, Hitler referred to it.
He did, and of course that's not the only hoax he's been involved in after his death.
Well, after his death, he was the subject of a hoax, the Hitler Diaries.
I think that's an example of a terrible forgery, but a great hoax, because actually the Hitler Diaries, if you read them, are really very badly written.
Well, you remind us, in the Hitler Diaries, Hitler complains of his terrible flatulence and bad breath.
He does, and he says, "Now a year is nearly over. Have I achieved my goals? Must get tickets for the Olympics for Eva." I mean, you couldn't make it up.
But somebody did.
They did indeed.
Who did? Who made it up?
Well, it was a money-hungry guy whose name was Kujau. Forgive me, German people, if I'm pronouncing that wrong. And he, of course, realised there was a massive market. I mean, you can imagine the thirst for information about Hitler's private thoughts.
Well, and he told people that the books, each covering a six-month period in Hitler's life, had been found in the wreckage of a plane crash in East Germany at the end of the war and fallen into the hands of an official who sold it to an antique dealer. This is sort of how many of the frauds make their way to the media. People are told, oh, dealers had it and they gave it to some other dealer.
There's always a kind of shady chain of events that leads to these amazing books suddenly turning up. And that's been the case ever since some of the earliest literary hoaxes back in the 18th century, like the poems of Thomas Chatterton. They always would appear in a locked casket in the storeroom of an old church in the West Country or something, and, you know, miraculous.
And tell us about these poems of Chatterton.
Chatterton was a boy in Bristol in the West Country of England in the 18th century who was a really talented poet, but he was never going to get anywhere as a writer. He couldn't afford to sort of apply himself to go to London and try and make it a profession. So he said he'd found these medieval poems by a guy called Rowley. And they're really good. I mean, people still love them now. He made them up for years and years and years, and in the end it did allow him to fulfill his dream at first. It took him to London. He was able to get great interest from some literary luminaries of the day, but unfortunately it wasn't enough to save him, and he came to a very tragic end. He killed himself when he was just a teenager, but he was a great genius.
But it reminds us that they do achieve a sort of immortality, the hoaxers.
I think they do. I mean, many of them are more famous than others. There are lots in my book that we've probably never heard of now.
Tell us your favorite. I mean, someone that no one's ever heard of, but what they've done is so incredible.
Okay, I think my very favorite hoax is one that dates from 19th century Paris. There was a guy called Franc-Denis Lucas, and he was a Frenchman who spectacularly duped the entire Parisian Academy and all the leading academics of his day by selling them a dossier of letters purporting to be from great historical figures. And they were all letters letters which sang the glory of France, or Gaul as it would have been, from people like Cleopatra, Mary Magdalene, Alexander the Great, all written in perfect idiomatic 19th century French. You have Cleopatra saying, "Dear Caesar, having a wonderful holiday here in Gaul, the food's great and the schools are truly excellent. I really think we should send our son here to be educated. Love, Cleopatra." And it's unbelievable that anybody would think this could be true, but they did.
Where do you think we are with hoaxes? You know, James Fry, one of the most recent. Do you think they're just going to continue?
I think they will. I mean, obviously the internet now plays a really important role in publishing of this kind, both in debunking hoaxes, but also in allowing anyone to get online and publish in that way what they claim to be the truth. And I think, as we've seen with A Million Little Pieces by the author you just mentioned, it can actually cause quite devastating fallout.
Because the things that are written about, people are suffering. Real people are really suffering.
That's right. I mean, you know, it is one thing for someone who's genuinely suffered from abuse or addiction to talk about it, but it means something very different if you're inventing that and passing it off as truth.
No. That's author Melissa Katsoulis. Her book is Literary Hoaxes, an Eye-Opening History of Famous Frauds. And Melissa, we mentioned the eye-opening part. One of our producers was shocked to learn that one of her favorite books, Go Ask Alice, which was supposed to be a cautionary tale of a high school girl, you know, exploring the world of drugs, and she becomes hooked and overdoses, was a fake.
Let me say, I too was devastated to discover this was a fake. I had no idea. I grew up with the book, as many people in their 30s and 40s will have done. But no, it was all written by this kindly Mormon grandmother, Beatrice Sparks, who had the best interests of our feckless youth at heart and thought, well, this is clearly the right way to put them off.
Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small.